Today on Eco Report.
In the future, our models predict the range of the Indiana bat could decrease by about 50% or more due to climate change.
Susan Loeb from the U.S. Forest Service talks about the Indiana bat population.
Eco Report is a weekly public affairs program
providing independent media coverage
of environmental and ecological studies
with a focus on local, state, and regional people, issues, and events
in order to foster open discussion
of human relationships with nature and the earth
and to encourage you to take personal responsibility for living sustainably in the world.
Eco Report is produced by an independent team of volunteers
working at the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
And financially supported by listeners like you.
Good morning and welcome to Eco Report. For WFHB, I'm David Lyman.
And I'm Phil Casper, bringing you environmental watchdog reporting from South Central Indiana.
A logging site on Scarcifat Ridge in Yellowwood State Forest in Brown County, Indiana, was the canvas for a recent art installation protesting the logging of trees in the woods. The Hills of Indiana Crochet and Knitting Society used yarn to weave together dozens of trees marked to be logged. Dubbed the Web of Life, the installation represents the interconnectedness of trees and their central role in the ecosystem. Creating the installation was a simple task, according to Vice President of the Society. It took only half an hour to string thousands of yards of yarn between the trees. The Hills of Indiana Crochet and Knitting Society encourages other crochet and knitting enthusiasts to take similar action to help protect the trees and the creatures that depend on them from the devastation of the Indiana Department of Natural Resources, which is wreaking havoc on Yellowwood and other state forests.
7 years after it was first proposed, the Monroe County Solid Waste Management District may be taking another stab at what's been known simply as the MRF project. In a meeting last week, the board discussed spending as much as $100,000 for consulting work related to the MRF, or Materials Recovery Facility. Once completed, the facility would process the county's recyclables, which could then be sold on the open market. The district's executive director, Tom McGlasson, said officials want to make some major changes to previous plans for the MRF.
This is something we've been revisiting over the past couple of months with the executive committee. You know, there's some things that were determined out of it, that the facility that was proposed at the landfill just did not have a large enough footprint, enough square footage to really allow us to do the volume of material that would be necessary to make a financially feasible facility. One of the big hitches in that is that there's not room in there to do material sorting. And if we were to look at accepting material from other entities, we did not find other entities that do the source separation that we do at our facilities. So thus, whatever they brought to us would require additional sorting on site. And there just was not room in the facility to put a sorting line in.
McGlasson discussed the MRF during a presentation about the district's budget for next year. The MRF project has been one of the longest debated and most contentious local government projects Monroe County has seen in recent decades. The district's board of directors have argued over the viability of the project for years, with County Commissioners Iris Kiesling and Patrick Stauffers as the primary opposition. Councilmember Steve Volan, who is also a volunteer at WFHB, has been one of the strongest proponents, along with the former director of the district, Larry Barker. Barker resigned from his job last year. Proponents have presented figures indicating the district would save money by selling recyclables rather than paying for the company Republic Services to haul them away. Volan has also raised questions about whether, in fact, Republic Services actually recycles all of the materials they haul away, or whether some ends up in the landfill. Opponents, like Iris Kiesling, have said there could be unexpected costs for a MRF. The Solid Waste Management District actually budgeted for the opening of a MRF last year, and they even managed to purchase a building, but the facility was never opened. During his budget presentation last week, Executive Director McGlasson said the board's executive committee still wants to open a facility, one that would process pre-sorted recyclables as well as unsorted garbage.
They came up with the following recommendations, which would be to proceed with a dual stream MRF in two phases at another location yet to be determined. A dual stream MRF would include both the clean stream or the source separated material from our sites, as well as a waste stream side where recyclables would actually be recaptured from the waste stream being thrown out by residents and businesses. It would need to be done in a dual stream. I see at the bottom there, materials recovered from a waste stream MRF have a much lower market value than our source separated material does, and in order to maximize the value and thus the revenue from the source separated material, those streams would need to be kept separate from each other in the processing facility.
McLassen presented a draft of a budget that includes $100,000 for consulting work related to the MRF. That would cover an engineering study, a business plan, and identification of a site for the facility.
A study by one of the country's leading planning firms reveals that a proposed linear park and trail system along the White River in Indiana would produce health and environmental benefits, plus add about $13 million annually to the region's economy. Indiana environmental advocates are promoting the Mounds Greenway, which would be built between Muncie and Anderson. Tim Maloney of the Hoosier Environmental Council says adding more space for residents to spend time outdoors would reduce health care costs because people would be able to engage in more physical activity. The Greenway would also reduce vehicle emissions because people would use it instead of cars for local travel, and it would save money when it comes to stormwater and flood control projects. Maloney says at the core of this project is conserving a free-flowing river and the natural areas along the White River, connecting the existing parks and enhancing the overall environment of that region.
The recent bankruptcy filings by Peabody Energy, the largest coal mining company in the U.S., disclose that the company has funded dozens of climate-denying scientists, nonprofits, and political organizations. Those organizations and individuals also oppose efforts to mitigate climate change, such as President Obama's plans to cut greenhouse gas emissions. The Peabody funds cover trade associations, corporate lobby groups, industry front groups, and conservative think tanks. The company also donated money to political parties and funded twice as many Republican groups as Democratic ones. Among the beneficiaries of Peabody's generosity is the Committee for Constructive Tomorrow, which advocates increased carbon dioxide emissions, arguing the greenhouse gas is beneficial to plant growth and thus good for the Earth. Another beneficiary is the Center for the Study of Carbon Dioxide and Global Change. The group's founder has said carbon dioxide isn't a pollutant, but, quote, the very elixir of life, unquote.
The Obama administration is poised to approve the mining of oil shale in southern Utah. Oil shale, which shouldn't be confused with shale oil, which is a product of fracking, is dirty. It's even dirtier than the tar sands, which is notorious as a dirty fuel. Oil shale isn't really oil at all. It's a rock that has to be superheated for a long time to release a sticky substance that requires more energy and processing to convert it to petroleum. By the time it's burned, oil shale emits greenhouse gases at a rate almost two times greater than does conventionally produced gasoline. The company that wants to mine Utah shale oil is Enefit, a wholly owned subsidiary of the Estonian government. The Utah state government and federal government are offering taxpayer money in the millions of dollars for the project. The Bureau of Land Management accepted public comments on the project until June 14th.
The American Lung Association's State of the Air 2016 report shows that cleaning up air pollution continues successfully in much of the nation. In the 25 cities with the worst pollution, including Indianapolis, the majority saw improvements from last year. Many saw their lowest levels ever of year-round particle pollution or ozone pollution. Thanks to stronger standards for pollutants, the United States has seen continued reduction in ozone and particle pollution as well as other pollutants for decades. Since 1970, the air has become cleaner while the population, energy use, and miles driven increased greatly. Overall, the best progress is attributable to cleaner power plants and increased use of cleaner vehicles and engines. Continued progress to cleaner air remains crucial to reduce the risk of premature death, asthma attacks, and lung cancer. The report adds a cautionary comment that a change in climate is making it harder to protect human health. Many cities reduced their ozone pollution over the last 4 years. Last year, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency updated and strengthened the National Ozone Standard, officially recognizing that ozone is unhealthy to breathe at lower levels than previously thought. The report indicated that 20 counties in Indiana received an F grade for ozone levels. Monroe was not among those listed. Only Elkhart and Lake counties received Fs for particle pollution. One suggestion for homeowners to reduce ozone: mow after 7 p.m. because the pollution will dissipate before the sun rises. Lawnmowers are typically more polluting than automobiles.
Scientists from the University of Queensland in Australia have determined that the Bramble K. melomys, a small rodent that lived exclusively on a minuscule island near the north coast of Australia, has become extinct because of human-caused climate change. The animal is the first mammal known to become extinct as a result of climate change. The researchers said the immediate cause of the extinction was sea level rise, but the underlying cause was climate change. At one time, the Bramble Cay Island housed thousands of melomys. However, the island is just 10 feet above sea level at its highest point and has been inundated with seawater on numerous occasions. The water drowned the melomys and ruined their habitat. The last time humans saw melomys was in late 2009. Climate change, deforestation, and wildlife trafficking are causing unprecedented permanent losses of plants and animals, according to the Center for Biological Diversity. That's the news for this week. For Eco Report, I'm David Lyman.
And I'm Phil Casper. Eco Report is brought to you in part by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
In today's Eco Report feature, Norm Holey interviews research ecologist Susan Loeb on the effects of white nose syndrome on bat populations.
This is Norm Holey for WFHB, and today I'm speaking with Dr. Susan Loeb. She's a research ecologist for the U.S. Forest Service. And she is an expert on bats, and so what's happening with the Indiana bat and the white nose syndrome? How did the bats survive the winter?
The Indiana bat is actually doing a little bit better than some of the other species, such as the little brown bat and the northern long-eared bat. But still, it is declining. In Indiana, the latest count was done in last year, in 2015. And so in Indiana, it was down about 18% from 2013. So down from about 225,000 bats down to about 185,000. Bats. So it is declining, but as I say, not as rapidly as some of the other species. So that's sort of good news for the Indiana bats. Other parts of the range, like in Tennessee, however, the Indiana bat is actually declining quite rapidly. So I'm not exactly sure why it's declining more rapidly, say, in Tennessee than Indiana. It might be due to slightly warmer temperatures, which allows the fungus to grow more rapidly. But that's just an area of ongoing research right now.
Is there any sort of net migration north by the Indiana bat at this point?
In general, when Indiana bats leave their hibernacula in the spring, most of the bats migrate north. There are some that do migrate south, and some that stay in the southern Appalachians. And we did some population modeling looking at the distribution of summer habitat in relationship to various summer environmental conditions. And what we found was that the average summer temperature was a big determinant of where Indiana bats went in the summer. And so when it got too warm, it looked like Indiana bats did not like to be in a particular area. And then we projected that out into the future given various climate scenarios. And what we found was that in the future, our models predict that the range of the Indiana bat could decrease by about 50% or more due to climate change. And that currently a majority of the summer habitat is in the Midwestern area, Missouri, Indiana, Illinois, that area. But that area is predicted to warm up quite rapidly. And so the our models predict that in the future, the majority of the good summer habitat, at least in terms of climate, will be in the Northeast and the Southern Appalachians. So we could see some changes in their distribution in the future.
One of the issues in Indiana has been whether to mark the northern long-eared bat as an endangered species on our state endangered species list. I'm just curious, are there other states where the long-eared bat is on an endangered species list?
Yes, I do believe there are. But currently, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has listed them as threatened.
Are there any populations that seem to be immune to the white nose syndrome?
Yes, there are several species of bats that do not seem to be affected by white nose syndrome, at least yet. So, for example, the Virginia big-eared bat, which is an endangered subspecies of bat. It's found in Tennessee, Virginia, and West Virginia. And it is hibernating in some of the same caves and mines that little brown bats and northern long-eared bats are in that are being affected by white nose syndrome. But the Virginia big-eared bat does not seem to be affected by it. They have detected the fungus on the bat, but have seen no signs of the disease, nor have they seen any mortality. In fact, this endangered subspecies has actually increased over the last several years as the other species have been declining. So that's very interesting. The big brown bat does get the fungus. It does show signs of the disease, but it seems to not, there's probably a little bit of mortality, but certainly not the mass mortality. And there have been several studies done in the laboratory that indicate that it may have some characteristics that help it to fight off the fungus.
Is the genetic diversity in, say, the Indiana bat wide enough that there's any hope that some population will ultimately survive the white nose syndrome?
Yes. There's actually a recent study did come out looking at the genetics of the Indiana bat, and across the range, there is pretty good diversity. So that doesn't seem to be a concern. And even in little brown bats, which have experienced extreme declines in the Northeast, like 90%, there are still some survivors. And so we don't know whether that's due to something about their genetics or something about their behavior or what, But we are, you know, seeing a very few number of survivors, and so we do hope that that is the basis for, you know, a recovering population.
Let's hope so. And I've been speaking with Dr. Susan Loeb. She's a research ecologist at the U.S. Forest Service. Thank you very much for the information.
Thank you.
It's 11:51 a.m. and you're listening to Eco Report on WFHB, bringing you environmental watchdog reporting from South Central Indiana.
Would you like to join the Eco Report crew? WFHB is looking for volunteer reporters and engineers to join our award-winning news department. We provide training and will work with all schedules. Just bring your love for the environment. For more information, email volunteer at wfhb.org or call 812-323-1200. It's time now for In Nature, a segment focusing on the flora and fauna of South Central Indiana.
This is In Nature.
Chipmunks are common mammals found here in Bloomington. However, a computer search reveals more about humans than the chipmunk. More entries were how to get rid of them than those providing species information. Chipmunks choose their den sites carefully and return to them year after year. They are considered a true hibernator since breathing, temperature, and heart rate go down significantly. They create a nesting area below the frost line where they sleep in a ball with their tails curled around them. If found when hibernating, they cannot be immediately roused, but require some time for their bodily processes to rise from this low point. In the fall, they spend significant time collecting seeds and storing them away separately from their sleeping area. They will eat from time to time from this winter stock and thus continue to metabolize. Another area must be provided in the burrow where they deposit these products of metabolism without contaminating their food and sleeping areas. They emerge from their burrows during unseasonably warm weather in the winter and eventually return to full behavior in the spring.
You've been listening to In Nature.
Now, a few local events of interest through our weekly event calendar. Brown County State Park will host a Sensational Snakes program on Friday, June 24th from 2 to 2:30 p.m. Snakes are a very important part of our ecosystem. Find out more about the snakes that call Brown County State Park home and have the chance to get up close and personal to one of these slithering friends. Meet at the Nature Center in the auditorium.
The Bloomington Garden Club's 2016 Summer Garden Walk will take place on Saturday, June 25th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. and also on Sunday, June 26th from 12 noon to 4 p.m. You will have an opportunity to enjoy five exceptional private gardens, Bloomington Gardens, observe watercolor artists painting in these wonderful local gardens, and more. The Garden Club supports children's gardening programs, civic planting, and beautification projects. This is a ticketed event. To learn more, go to bloomingtongardenclub.com.
The Monroe County Energy Challenge is hosting its second annual Explore Energy Fair at Bloomington City Hall during the Farmers Market on Saturday, June 25th from 9:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. The fair will include electric bicycle races, a photo booth with props and the energy mobile, a human-powered booth, and a water wheel game.
Are you paying too much for utilities? This summer, the Monroe County Energy Challenge will provide free air sealing and attic insulation for 50 Monroe County homes. Save up to $600 per year on utility bills and save up to $1,400 on contractor fees and improve the comfort of your home. The Monroe County Energy Challenge is accepting applications on a rolling basis until filled. Call 812-349-3558 to learn more about this opportunity.
That wraps up our show for this week. Eco Report is brought to you in part by Solar Systems of Indiana, designing and installing renewable energy systems. SSI is a member of the North American Board of Certified Energy Practitioners and works to foster the acceptance of solar energy across the Midwest through education and consultation. More information by phone at 812-336-2785 or online at solarsystemsofindiana.com.
This week's news stories were written by Norm Holley, Joe Crawford, and Linda Green. Our event calendar was compiled by Juliana Daly. Our broadcast engineer is Jennifer Brooks. Eco Report is produced by Juliana Daly and Felice Chichek. Our executive producer is Joe Crawford. For WFHB, I'm David Lyman.
And I'm Phil Casper. Join us next week on Eco Report when Norm Holley interviews horticulturist Larry Kaplan. Larry describes current growing conditions and things listeners should be prepared to deal with in their flower and vegetable gardens. He also talks about pollination and the status of honeybees. On Eco Report, encouraging you to take collective action to defend the earth.
You've been listening to the Eco Report,
a volunteer-powered production of Community Radio WFHB
in Bloomington, Indiana.
Available for download and podcast at news.wfhb.org.
Eco Report is your independent, ecologically inspired news source
for South Central Indiana,
bringing you news that the Earth wants you to hear.
Send your comments, suggestions, and story ideas
directly to the Eco Report staff.
The email address is
earth@wfhb.org.
That's earth@wfhb.org.